Well, good morning, everyone. We are winding down on Daniel. We have our chapter today. We have our chapter next week, and that will bring our study of the prophet Daniel to a conclusion. So I wanted to, with this chapter on Susanna, I wanted to say a couple things. As I remarked last time, in Protestant Bibles, this is Apocrypha. The second half of chapter 2, and then 13 and 14, they're considered Apocrypha because, remember, there are these two there are these two canons, in the two Hebrew canons. The earlier canon, around the time of the Septuagint, was broader in terms of what it allowed to be inspired. This later canon that happened about 300 years later, and after the time of Christianity, excluded things through a number of considerations. One, that it wasn't originally written in Hebrew, or they didn't have a Hebrew version. That it was after certain dates. And so books like Sirach, sometimes it's called Ecclesiasticus, the earliest version we have of that is Greek. Tobias, I forget what Tobias is. That's in the Septuagint. I forget if the issue there is a language issue. But with Daniel, remember, most of Daniel, what we have is we have parts of it in Hebrew. We have the middle section of it, which is in Aramaic. And then we have these chapters at the end, 13, 14, and then part of 2, which are in Greek. And the conjecture is that there were earlier Hebrew versions of them, but we simply don't have them. Okay, and frankly, I think in a way, I think it's a shame that Daniel 13 gets cut, because I think there's a lot to get from it, as I hope to demonstrate today. One of the points, by the way, the issue of language and whether there was a Hebrew version or not, this was an issue early on. So in the 4th century, we have an exchange between Origen, who was an early Christian writer, and I think it's Julian Africanus, about chapter 13. And Julian has a number of objections to it being inspired, and then Origen responds to the objections. And one of the issues that comes up about the language is, if you recall, when the judges are interrogated and they're asked, and they're separated so that you can get different testimony, under what tree did you see Susanna and her lover? And one group says under a holm tree, one of the judges says under a holm tree, and the other one, I think, says under a mastic tree. And you can't get it in English, but the term that's used for, I think it's holm tree, is related to the Greek word for cutting. So that's why it is, you see, by your fine lie, you will be cut in two. And the other one is, it's similar. There are these puns that are being made on the tree, and then the punishment that they're going to receive for their perjury. Because remember, at the point where their testimony is conflicting, then they're not telling the truth. And so Julian wants to say, well, if they're making puns in Greek, how doesn't that suggest that Greek is the original language and this isn't written in Hebrew? And Origen writes back and says, you might have something there, but the problem is making sure what kind of trees are being talked about. It's like the problem I have when I go with my wife to the Asian food store. When I go to Trung Tong, which is in downtown Minneapolis, or Sun Foods in Brooklyn Park, or Dragon Star, my wife will have names for fruits that are different in Chinese. So you can't always, but sometimes they're just labeled lemongrass, and lemongrass is lemongrass. But there are other things that her name for it isn't the same as the Chinese name. And you have that same problem when you've got things, plants or trees, labeled in Greek, then you're not sure what the Hebrew people would be calling those trees or what the Babylonians would be calling those trees. So you're not exactly sure what tree you're talking about. So Origen says part of the problem is that. I wanted to see kind of where this was, and I was reading something, again, one of the Anglican commentaries, the so-called Speaker's Commentary, and the guy says, well, actually, this isn't really an objection at all, and he gives three different trees in Hebrew where the verb for the tree sounds like a word that would mean either to strike or cut or punish or beat. So in other words, it could have been trees that would fit, and what the Greek translator did was bring it over to trees that would fit the Greek language and then the Greek verb. Okay, so this could work in Hebrew. There are trees that the names are similar enough to verbs that would be involved with punishment that you actually could have it being carried over that way. One of the issues, of course, that also comes up is, since it's being narrated, we have this thing that in some editions, early editions, this story was a preface. So this story essentially came as chapter one. It's in the Septuagint, it comes as editions afterwards. And so then there was the question, well, if it's not Daniel, is it still inspired? You know, in other words, if somebody right after Daniel's time saw that Daniel left this out, wrote it down, and put it in, does that somehow undermine that it would be part of Daniel and therefore inspired? And it's interesting because this is a question that John Henry Newman raises, and he brings in Daniel as part of a series of texts that he talks about. So, for example, if in the Gospel of John, where you know, it looks like John ends in 20, but then in 21 there's this thing that looks like a kind of an additional add-on, or better, the Psalms of David, right? By the time of the Council of Trent, so by the 1500s, there was enough kind of critical scholarship that they could look at it and realize this isn't all David. Okay, is it still inspired if it's not David? So, and the answer they came to was, of course, yes. So, in other words, the standard that they're using is not just that the person that it's attributed to is the author, but that that it's under the same, if you like, influence or the same direction. Okay, so that what you have at the end of Daniel, if what's being added on there is something that's from Daniel's life that fits with Daniel, where it's sort of being completed, that doesn't undermine its inspiration, right? If, for example, at the end of Numbers, where Moses' death is being reported, does that mean, is Moses foreseeing his own death and like writing that down? No, that can be added by the same, if you like, inspiration that's guiding the whole thing. So it's not mandatory from the church's point of view that everything that's in a book called Daniel or let's say Numbers or the Gospel is written by the author himself, but that certainly the majority or the burden of it is, but that the things can then be added on, if you like, by the author's influence. By the author's influence. For example, if Daniel told somebody about this episode, or this episode was commonly known with Susanna, and then it's written up and added, that's under the same inspiration, if you like, that the rest of Daniel is. Okay? So that's why, if it's not Daniel, that doesn't subtract from it being inspired. One of the things that I had wanted to point out about, you know, letting go of the story of Susanna of 13, you know, in the traditional lectionary, and when I say traditional lectionary, the lectionary going back really to 600s, 700s, you know, going back pretty far, Daniel 13 was read on the third Saturday of Lent. So in fact, this coming Saturday was the traditional day that that this episode was read, and it was paired with the gospel from John 8, that is the woman taken in adultery. You know, so those stories were paired together for centuries as a kind of reflection or commentary on each other. Allow me to say that one of the disadvantages of the current way that we read Scripture in the Catholic Church, I mean liturgically, we now have cycle A and B, I guess, for Gospels, and we've got A, B, and C for letters, and the idea there is that you're giving your hearers a broader range of Scripture to listen to. From that point of view, yes, it's always good that people have a broader range of things to listen to, that they're exposed to more of the Bible. But the disadvantage, remember, all these things that are advantages, they always come with corresponding disadvantages. The disadvantage is that when you had set readings that were always the same, it allowed you to associate definite readings with definite points in the year. To the point that when you look at what used to be called the Sundays after Pentecost, that has now become the vast uncharted ocean of what we now call ordinary time. It used to be that each of those Sundays was named after the gospel. So there was a Sunday of the publican and the Pharisee, and there was a Sunday of the the Good Samaritan, and you're right, all these Sundays had a definite character that came from the gospel for that day. And by the way, after the Protestant break, there were many of the Protestant communions where that continued. So if you look at the lectionary from the Church of England in 1850, it's identical to the lectionary in the Catholic Church. If you look at the lectionary for the Lutheran Church, it's identical to what it is that the Catholics had. There was this broad consensus on these are the readings. And what happened in the 1950s and 60s was that through this sort of enrichment process, we no longer have weeks or Sundays or, you know, that have this definite character taken from the reading. And not only did that happen in the Catholic world, it happened in the Anglican world, it happened in the Lutheran world. So the paradoxical thing that one has to observe here, in an earlier age in which we didn't really even think or talk about ecumenism, we were actually on the same page in terms of our lectionaries and our readings. In the age in which we are all about love sharing and, you know, hey, what are you doing? What are we doing? Can we get together on this? We have lectionaries that are all over the place. We were more unified when we didn't care about unity. Yeah, go ahead.
So when you go to the Catholic Church and the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church on the same weekend, is
yes,
the same gospel reading, did they work together?
I don't know if they worked together. What could happen, remember, they didn't just completely change. So there are Sundays where they stuck to the traditional, you know, the traditional reading for that day. So probably what you're seeing is the leftovers of that agreement on the lectionary. In other words, there are certain, for example, take this one. The first Sunday, the temptation of Christ in the desert, right? That for the first Sunday of Lent. That's going to be very commonly shared. There are certain Sundays, there are going to be certain Gospels that just are sort of immovable. And the temptation in the desert, that is so entrenched as an opening to Lent that that's going to be hard to shake. But are you saying this is routinely so? Yeah, so I'd be interested in what, if there was some kind of collaboration in terms of what we're all going to read. Although Missouri Synod, usually, since those are the more traditional branches of Lutherans, they're not too eager to be on the same page as Catholics. That's not, you know, it's more the ELCA. ELCA is more, the ELCA tends to be much more open to some kind of ecumenical discussion with Catholics. Generally, the more conservative Wisconsin Synod Lutheran, Missouri Synod Lutheran. On the one hand, there's a greater agreement in terms of, for example, you can run into Wisconsin Synod Lutherans, Missouri Synod, who, because they follow the large and small catechism of Luther, they believe in real presence. They believe that Jesus is really present in the Eucharist. And when you go on an ELCA website, there will be kind of a range of things that they're going to believe about the Eucharist. But that tends, that conservatism, if you like, about doctrine and maybe about liturgy in some sense, tends to be accompanied by kind of a greater distrust and greater criticism of Catholics and the Catholic Church. Because remember, the more you're going to sort of look to Luther, the more that you're going to have sort of graver disagreements about where the church is, Catholic Church is at with doctrine as opposed to the direction Luther went. Yeah. It's odd. Sometimes the people who, in terms of their belief, are closer together, they actually have a harder time getting along. The classic example of that would be the Eastern Orthodox. The Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholics. Not so much on the Catholic side. Catholics tend to be open but sort of patronizing. Oh, those icons you have all over the place, those are so neat! Catholics tend to be affirming in this almost kind of patronizing sort of way, whereas the Eastern Orthodox, they just tend to be cranky. And there are these historical injuries which they perceive from Catholics. Some not entirely perceived, some of them can be very real. But they, the Eastern Orthodox, like many traditionally minded people, have long memories. So there are things that happened in 1000 and 1400 that they have never forgotten, and they won't forgive. So, but in terms of who's closer on the same page in terms of belief, right? The Eastern Orthodox believe in seven sacraments, and we believe in seven sacraments. The Eastern Orthodox believe in the hierarchy of priest, of deacon, bishop, priest, deacon. We believe in that, right? There are all these things that are the same. Yeah, go ahead.
So during the Reformation, that's when the Protestant Church really looked at all the books of the Bible and said, we don't like that one's in there.
Well, I wouldn't say they don't like. I mean, they went with this later canon and this later Jewish canon. And again, I think I knew at one point why they chose the later canon, but I just don't remember anymore, and I keep forgetting to look it up. But that's Maccabees, obviously, was one of the ones. Maccabees, you could understand from a perhaps a Lutheran point of view, because it talks about prayers for the dead. It is a holy and wholesome thought to pray for the dead. That's in Maccabees. That's a kind of a source text for purgatory. So if for you purgatory is wrapped up with indulgences and all of that Renaissance decadence, it's understandable why you want to cut loose on Maccabees. Yeah. Go ahead.
Do you think they would ever add more additional cycles for our readings? I mean, I know we have A, B, and C right now. There's four Gospels. I mean, would they ever?
I don't know. I don't know what they would do. I don't always understand how the process for why we do what we do liturgically.
Yeah. It exposes us to more of the Bible, right?
Yeah, I mean, it exposes the ones who are paying attention. I mean, quite honestly, I guess my defense of the traditional lectionary was, if you have the same readings year after year, they tend to stick. If you have varied readings, then it tends not to stick, because people are influenced by what is the same. If you have this point of view that things have to be different in order to be interesting and exciting, that works for a while. But long term, what works with people is that there are routines, there are rituals, that it's always the same. You come back to it, you know it. And, you know, holidays are like this. I mean, you may have these ideas once you get to church that, oh, why does it have to be this way? Or why does it have to be that way? You have this idea of liturgical creativity where, you know, you could just sort of make up liturgy. But If somebody did that to your Thanksgiving or your Christmas, you'd be all bent out of shape. No, we're having potatoes and stuffing. No, we open one present on Christmas Eve. That's it. It's one present. You have these family rituals that are like written in stone, but somehow if it's the church rituals, then, oh, I don't see why we have to do it that way. I don't see why we have to do it that way. No, there is more reason for the church to do what she does century after century than to have whatever menu you have for Thanksgiving or whatever ritual you have for presents. But those things have more emotional weight for us. That's what's going on. In an earlier age, people had that kind of emotion about the liturgy. They had that kind of emotion. So they didn't want people screwing around with their liturgy. They didn't want this change or that change. No, we have always done it this way. That's a kind of an argument. And once you make lots and lots of changes, you undermine people's emotional attachment to ritual. That's probably the most devastating effect in the changes of the last 50 years, is that people don't have a sense liturgically of stability and permanence. It's what Mother Angelica used to call the electric mass, because you're going to show up and there's always going to be a shock. Go ahead, Jill.
Well, it's interesting, the growth of the movement of the Latin mass, that's really starting to grow because people are wanting to get back.
Sure, but I mean, it's small growth. You know, it's like 200 parishes nationwide to 500 parishes nationwide. That's not a lot, but you're right.
Compared to a few years ago, there
was
zero.
Yeah, you're right. But there are a lot of people I know who, when they attend the Latin Mass, you know, they ask, "Well, you know, you didn't grow up with this Mass. You don't have Latin. Why are you here?" And there are a lot of people in the Latin Mass. It's not because they're sort of traditional or traditionalist. They're just tired of the changes. I come here and it's the same thing, and it's the same thing every Sunday. There's a script, they follow it. That's all I want. I don't want it's this option, that option, that option, this thing, that thing. We might do this. We're going to have the children all come up to the front. Father's going to start Mass. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Father. How are we all doing today? We're all very well, Father. Right? They just don't want that anymore. So it's not because they have been formed, as it were, in a traditional liturgy. They're simply exhausted by the Reformed liturgy. They're simply exhausted by the Reformed liturgy. Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Tuwiel. I'm going to have to march on to Susanna.
Very pertinent discussion yesterday on Relevant Radio about anti-culturalism. So if people want to listen to that, I was a professor out of Notre Dame. He wrote a book, and I can't quote it, but something about the failed liberalism and something. But basically, it's anti-Catholic, anti-anything with attachments, like you said. This is kind of what the culture is, or the anti-culture is occurring with that program. So they don't have those.
So I haven't listened to that, but about 4 years ago, Anthony Esselin, long time at Providence College and now at Thomas More College, he would talk about how it is that Catholics can't dialogue with modern culture because there's no such thing. Modern, what we call modern culture, is an anti-culture. It dissolves cultures. It's a solvent. So anything traditional you bring to it, it just, right, turns it into goo. So how do you address a culture in a way that's not a culture, that's anti-culture? And what he meant by that was, at the point where everything is fad, 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 pop sensation, pop sensation, pop sensation, fashion, 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 that's not a culture. A culture is something that is something where you got it from your parents, who got it from their parents, who got it from their parents, that it's something that has this continuity over a very long period of time. That's a culture. In a way, pop culture is almost an oxymoron. You know, a culture is something that lasts beyond, you know, the fads and whatnot. So I got on this because I was talking about this liturgical pairing, and the point that's made is that these are complementary readings. That what you have in the gospel is this woman taken in adultery, who is forgiven by our Lord. And that, if you like, is a kind of image of the church in its sinful humanity that's being purified by our Lord, that's being forgiven and restored. But what it is that you see in Susanna, this is the purified church. This is the holy church. This is a church that actually is free from blame. Now, simply because the church is free from blame doesn't mean that it doesn't get accused and attacked. But then that church is, by the power of God, vindicated. That church is, by the power of God, vindicated. So Susanna becomes a kind of image of the church, an image of the innocence of the church, of the redeemed church, of the perfected church. In the catacombs in Rome, they would have images of Susanna at trial, and Daniel kind of speaking out for her, because the early Christians saw Susanna as a kind of model for not just for living in the face of persecution, but also for the church itself, because they were at a stage where they saw again the church as this. As this bride that had been given this abundance of graces by Christ, and yet, right, still attacked by the devils, still attacked by the pagans, still attacked by the surrounding society. So you look in these catacombs and you find images of Susanna. Again, I think another example of why we should think of this as an inspired text and not just kind of an edifying add-on. Notice that the way that the sight of the Lord is used in this. The elders will say that, or the narrator rather says that when they're inflamed with desire for Susanna, they no longer look to heaven or to just judgments. Okay, and then the language in 23. Susanna says, I'm hemmed in on every side. If I do this thing, it's death to me. And if I do not, I shall not escape your hands. I choose not to do it and fall into your hands rather than sin in the sight of the Lord. Okay? And this is language that's picked up by St. Alphonsus Liguori. It's so lovely. I want to quote it directly. Hold on a second, we are experiencing technical difficulties. Here it is. Okay. So, the saints by the thought of God, the saints, by the thought that God was looking at them, have bravely repelled all the assaults of their enemies. This thought gave courage to Holy Susanna to resist the temptations of the elders, even to despise their threats against her life. And she courageously said to them, "It's better for me to fall into your hands without doing it than to sin in the sight of the Lord. It is better to fall into your hands and to die without sin, to offend God before his face." And then he gives another example that, let me just give you this one too. This thought also converted a wicked woman who dared to tempt St. Ephrem. If you don't know St. Ephrem, he's called St. Ephrem the Syrian. And he's one of our early early hymn writers. So St. Ephrem the Syrian wrote a number of hymns that were used in the Eastern Church, in the Eastern part of the, among Eastern Christians. And what does he say? The saint told her that if she wished to sin, she must meet him in the middle of the city. "But," said she, "how is it possible to commit sin before so many people?" "And how," replied the saint, "is it possible to sin in the presence of God, who sees us in every place?" At these words, she burst into tears and, falling prostrate on the ground, asked pardon of the saint and besought him to point out to her the way of salvation. Saint Ephrem placed her in a monastery where she led a holy life, weeping over her sins until death. Okay, that's in the traditions of the early church. That's what we call a happy ending. Okay, So that language of the sight of the Lord, it's something you can read by and just kind of let it blow past. But St. Alphonsus emphasizes it because it's what it is that leads those elders away from the right way of life, that they no longer think of God looking at them. They no longer think of themselves in the sight of God. And it's what allows Susanna to persevere under very, very difficult circumstances, that she always thinks of herself in the sight of God. By the way, Mrs. Delmore was asking me, when they talk about love in the translation, is that what the translation has, by the way? And they confess that they love her? Let's see. Yeah, 20. We are in love with you. The Greek word I'm looking at is epithumia. And epithumia means we desire you. So love is a little, that's a little free. I thought if it was love and it was going to be more literal, then the word would be eros, erao, right? We have, like, erotic, right? We have a passionate sexual love for you. But no, it's just epithumia. We want you. So that's the word that's used in the Greek at the beginning and then in the middle. They don't. In other words, they're not trying to sweet talk her. You know, they're just kind of laying out the facts. Here it is. This is what we want, and this is what will happen to you if you don't. When I was looking up when I read that Susanna was on the catacombs, it led me to these other artistic depictions of Susanna. You get into the Renaissance, and you get these paintings of, like, Susanna looking like she's flirting with these guys. And there's just something about the Renaissance. On the one hand, you want to admire their artistic genius, but there are a lot of them, and once it comes to religious topics, they are just wheels off. That's kind of the problem with the Renaissance, is they become so enamored of their technical skill and their realism and so on, that they just become very free with what they do with their subject matter, which is almost always religious subject matter. In fact, even when they're doing pagan subject matter, they become very free. They start humanizing and sensualizing religious things. By the way, if you're from an Asian culture, for example, the Philippines, right, my wife's country, she looks at that Renaissance art and she thinks it's all decadent. Why? Because in Asia in general, you do not show nudity. So that's why it is. When you look at art from China or Japan or the Philippines, there's no nudity. India, you do not show nudity. And you know, we have this kind of artistic view of nudity. You know, it's not meant to be tantalize or sensualize. It's, you know, the beauty of the human body. They have no blah, 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 blah. They have no time for that. That modesty requires that there simply not be an unveiling of the human body. By the way, you can see this in movies. If you ever watch Hollywood movies or Bollywood movies, movies from India, They will not show people kissing. That is not appropriate. That is excessive. So even from their point of view, even these movies that we have from the 1950s, where people sort of romantically kiss, that's decadent. So even our standards, that going back to what we consider kind of like the golden age of television and movies, when the censors were actually busily at work, that is too loose of a standard for the East. Let's get to this to what I've called here the moral dilemma. And I have dilemma in quotes because, is she going to sin with them and save her life? Is she going to cry out and be accused and be unable to prove her innocence and therefore be executed? We use the word dilemma a little freely. Strictly speaking, a dilemma is really, when you talk about a moral dilemma is where both of your choices are morally problematic. There isn't a clear or obvious choice, because there are moral downsides to both options. This is not a moral dilemma, because if you should never sin to save your own life. It may be a dilemma in the sense that I want to live, but the moral command is clear. There's nothing, it is not easy to do. That's the problem. We use the word dilemma about anything where it's difficult to do. But if you've, if you've done something that's harmed somebody else, yes, it may be difficult to fess up and own to that, but that's what you're required to do. That isn't really a dilemma. That's not really a moral dilemma anyway. So I will talk about Susanna when we do the unit with sophomores on one may one do evil that good may come of it. And it's funny because some of the sophomores think that they reject the principle. In other words, they think that sometimes evil is necessary. The problem is that they very often will use the example of lying. And the difficulty there is that most of them don't believe that lying is wrong. So I have to point out to them, this is not an example against the principle, one may never do evil, the good may come of it, because you don't think that lying is wrong. If you thought that lying was wrong, then it would be an example. The thing that I try to bring out is that you've got to choose something that you really do think is wrong, and then ask yourself, okay, is that something I would do to, like, let's say, save life or save my family or save the country? Or, I remember once we were talking about lying. I said, move it over to another area. If lying is kind of not clear for you, would you prostitute your mother to save life? Right? I remember one boy in the back who said, well, how many lives? Now, by the way, I found out later that boy, when you listen to that, doesn't that just sound so, like, dysfunctional? Doesn't that just sound off? Well, I found out years later that that boy, his parents had divorced, and he blamed his mother for the divorce. So, of course, that's what his response is. But you can get that. I mean, you can get those, depending on what's going on out there, I mean, you can get that as a response. So then as you keep talking it through, one of the things I want to get students to see is, are you making your physical life, are you making your survival the highest good? In other words, what is the highest good for you? Are moral and spiritual things the highest good, and life is meant to serve that? Or is your physical life the highest good? And to the extent that things there are these moral and spiritual goods, that's meant to support your physical life. Okay? Because the thing that you have to understand is that in the Bible, that as you get these narratives, as you get a narrative like Susanna, the clear teaching of that narrative is that your physical life is secondary to moral and spiritual goods. And so the issue isn't, may one do evil that good may come of it. It took me a while to realize this with students, and in fact there was one year in particular where I had this group of boys that they were adamant about. I think they had been like binge watching 24, So if you've ever watched 24, there are all these kind of moral dilemmas about what are you willing to do to save the country, to save this group of people, to save the plane, to save the president, right? There are all this. So they were nourished on that, on those narratives. They wanted to come up with all these things that were morally shady that you have to do if you're going to save the country, save the nation, save the plane of people, etc. Okay? And but then the principle you're working from is that survival is the highest good. Survival is the highest good. Is that what you believe? Would you do anything to save life? There's no act so disgusting, so disgraceful that you wouldn't do. And for a number of them, they were perplexed. They didn't quite know what to think. because they have this strong emotional attachment to thinking that, well, you know, you do not want to in some way contribute to somebody's death or contribute to an injustice when you could have done something about it. So, for example, I gave them the scenario that's in Measure for Measure. Measure for Measure, Shakespeare's play, this man is on trial for, he's going to be executed for fornication, for getting this woman pregnant. And his sister, who's about to enter the convent, she comes in and says, you know, would you please let my brother go? Please be merciful. And Angelo, who's the judge, says, I will let your brother go if you sleep with me. Okay? I will let your brother go if you sleep with me. And I told students that, and I had one girl say, well, but wouldn't you want your, let's say if you were in that situation, and it's husband and wife instead of brother and sister, wouldn't you want your wife to sleep with somebody if it meant slaving your life? Wouldn't she feel bad if she could have saved your life by that action and failed to do so? Okay? Now, obviously, part of the problem there is that I think students confuse responsibility. So, in other words, if I don't go along with what a bad person wants or says they want, then I'm somehow responsible. Okay? Whereas, no, that's not true. You are not required to follow the will of an evil person, because then what happens is you're complicitous with the evil. In any event, that was their stand. And so when they asked me that, wouldn't you want your wife to do this? I said, you know what? I will go home and ask Mrs. Hippler. And I came back the next day. And I said, I put the scenario to my wife. And here's what she said. I put what you said to me. I'm being held by the tyrant. The tyrant's enamored of my wife. Wouldn't I want my wife to sleep with the tyrant if it meant that I could go free and live? And honey, what do you think of that? Would you do that? And my wife said, I might. But then I would resent you for the rest of our marriage, because you would be the source of my defilement. And I brought that to my students because I said, notice what Mrs. Hippler is appealing to here. She's not appealing to some kind of notion of physical harm or physical damage or whatnot. She's appealing to this notion of defilement. That means that there's something that you're meant to have on the inside that when you consent to evil, it's gone. When you consent to evil, it's gone or dirtied or ruined in some way. Okay? When Mrs. Hippler appeals to this term defilement, she's obviously taking a stand that not just that there are goods beyond physical goods, but that those inner goods or moral goods or spiritual goods are more important than those physical goods. I think where I in recent years where I've ended up is that when you make physical goods the highest goods, you essentially think of yourself as an animal. Animals have no moral or spiritual goods. All they have is survival and survival of the species, and then these sort of urges and emotions and instincts that allow them to act for that. To be human means that you have a mind and will that allows you to rise above those things. Right? When Susanna takes her stand and says, no, I'm not going to sleep with you to save my life because I am not going to sin in the sight of the Lord. She has this idea of that is a spiritual, moral one that no animal could ever have. Right? That no animal could have that. And then, in a way, you're losing what's most distinctive to yourself. When you make survival the highest good, you're losing the thing in you that's the most distinctive. Animals can survive. Animals can be programmed to act for the survival of those around them and make choices that, I don't know, we would consider ambiguously moral if they were choosing, if they had minds, but they don't, right? It is a distinctively human thing to be able to sacrifice your life for some kind of higher principle that you understand, for a spiritual principle. Okay. Go ahead.
So, at the risk of
throwing this out there.
Go ahead.
The whole hashtag Me Too movement.
I'm a man, so I couldn't possibly comment on that. What do I know?
Good way to get out of it.
Thank you.
Because the whole idea is that they sacrificed something of themselves to get something that they wanted, but there's never any condemnation for that person that chose to.
Because that sounds like you're blaming the victim.
Because
that sounds like you're blaming the victim, and nobody wants to blame the victim. Or make it sound like you're blaming the victim.
I'm not. I didn't say that.
No. Modern society.
Yeah.
I just threw it out there.
Yeah. So, in other words, I have a right to being a popular actress. So, therefore, if there's a casting couch, yeah. Oh, that's the term going back to the 1920s. You've never heard it?
Casting couch.
Yes. That goes back to the 1920s, 1930s. Yeah. So, I mean, that's. But remember, the thing, especially about acting, when you go back to the world of Shakespeare, I mean, actors and actresses were considered in the same company as thieves and prostitutes. They were, it's only in I would say the last century that actors and actresses have status. That was always considered a shady world, and so. I don't know what I have to say to the Me Too business, but I would say this, that it takes place in a world, generally, I mean, if you're talking about the world of entertainment, that takes place in a world that for centuries people thought of as a morally shady world. And it's only now that we sort of impute to that world that it should operate by the same standards as everything else. Remember, you're talking about a world where professionally people pretend to be other people. I mean, or it's a world in which people live by making themselves the center of attention. That has its own difficulties. I remember, in fact, I got asked this by students because I gave the example. It was on the same topic, and they were saying, "Well, we were talking about the Bourne identity, and I was talking about the moral problems involved in being a spy, that you never know who you are." It isn't just movies. Read John le Carré, right? John le Carré has made a whole career. John le Carré, he isn't just some writer. He worked for M15. He's a former British intelligence agent. And he talks about the problem of working in the Secret Service or intelligence and so on, is that like acting, you have to pretend that you're other people, or you're always in some kind of role where there's some kind of deception involved, and you really lose a sense of who you are. Just like being a chef, we all know what the occupational hazards of being a chef are. You're there with delicious food all the time. Okay, well, being an actor, actress, entertainer, generally the people that I think we know that we really respect and admire as entertainers, it's something they do, but it's not the center of their lives. They are able to go and they have kind of normal family lives, and they kind of limit to the degree to which that's the center. But that takes an unusual kind of temperament that you're able to sort of wall that off and say, no, I'm going home to my wife and kids. I'm going to, live a normal life. I'm not going to be the center of attention. Taylor, you had...
Well, Meryl Streep was one of those actresses people look up to, like Oprah. I mean, she must be perfect, right? She was getting one of those awards a few years ago, Academy Award or something, and she goes, blah, 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 and I'd like to thank God, and she goes, Harvey Weinstein. But I mean, when she said, I'd like to thank God, everybody's, she talked about Harvey Weinstein, and they're, oh.
Yes. Well, but that's, you will never work in this town again. I mean, there are plenty of worlds in which people at the top have that. Yeah, I have that kind of power. They have that kind of power. Very good. So next week we'll talk about... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Scroll.
I'm going to change the subject and ask if you have a timeline for the canons that you talked about.
The first canon which accepted these books, I want to say is around 200 BC. And then the later one, I forget what the... I forget what their names are. The later one, I think, is called the Palestinian one. And that's like around 200.
Has a diagram, though, like a flow chart thing?
Oh, I'm sure there is one. I mean, I've only read it in these dusty old books, so I haven't seen it with the pretty chart. But I would be happy to dig it up and send it your way. Very good. Next week. Thank you.